All right, good evening. Welcome. So tonight I wanted to take a little break in our year-long exploration of the hindrances and the seven factors to bring forth climate change as a gateway into the Dharma, as a way to use the Dharma practice as a way to work with this very pressing issue of our times. And if you look at that sense of climate change, it is perhaps one of the most significant things that we're dealing with as a species right now. And the choices that we make now will have tremendous effects in the future. So how does our Dharma practice come to bear upon this very important subject? I often like to reflect on what are some Dharma gates into any particular topic we might be exploring, including this one. And tonight I'll talk about two main gateways. One is through understanding the effects of delusion in this topic, how we tend to ignore or deny, try to avoid this topic, this, as Al Gore's movie, The Unfortunate Truth or Inconvenient Truth. And delusion, again, is one of the fundamental roots of our suffering. And it's one of these fundamental kleshas that create this whole mass of suffering, this confusion about how things actually are. So we see that as meditators in this moment-by-moment unfolding of our experience, this very moment-by-moment arising of the sense of self and how we invest in that or see that as empty. If we don't see that, we're confused about that, then we create this whole other realm of greed and hatred from that. We take that same quality of delusion into this topic, this reality of climate change, and it can be very helpful. This also ties into this month's topic of sloth and torpor, which, as I spoke about 2 weeks ago, can be seen as an expression of delusion. The other gateway we'll explore tonight is that of the precepts and of non-harm, and how this shows up in the Eightfold Noble Path, how we can't just take our practice as this internal thing we only do on the cushion, but it has to go out into the world, out into how we interface with other people through our livelihoods, and expanding even further into how we treat the earth, how we treat the stewardship of this planet. Now, I first started to hear about climate change about 30 years ago when I was studying for my Bachelor's of Science in Forest Resource Management. And it was interesting at the time because I remember one professor in particular was looking at the different data and saying, well, you know, it could be caused by humans, or it could be just part of this natural swing up and down. So this is 30 years ago that he was expressing this. Now, present time, there's universal agreement that this is a reality, that there is change, that climate is changing based on our activity, that the greenhouse gases are increasing, temperature is changing and increasing again and again, year after year. One statement I found from the NASA website is, observations throughout the world make it clear that climate change is occurring, and that rigorous scientific research demonstrates that the greenhouse gases emitted by human activities are the primary driver. That was actually back in 2009. And 10 years later, we're even more clear about this. Another thing I learned in that's a Bachelor of Science program, which is the effects of ecosystems and how populations of animals sometimes push into their habitat, exceeding what their habitat can hold. Right? So you have a big growth of population, they don't have enough food, and there's this die-off, and there's this kind of back and forth. So from a certain perspective, that's what we're doing as humans, that we're exceeding our capacity for our environment. You know, there will be consequences for that. There will be a sense of a die-off. You know, from a certain perspective, the Earth is used to populations and species coming and going. And there's been times when there's been 90% of species on Earth have died away in a short period. What's different about this is that this is generated by one species. You know, and so we're creating our own demise beyond our habitat. You know, there will be life, you know, probably cockroaches and dandelions and things like that, but you know, we may not be forefront to that. But the good news is that we do have this potential for changing this course through our actions. We can actually see the direction. Our scientists are showing that there's this clear trajectory, and there's still a chance for us to alter that, to make a significant change in this. So if the problem is so clear, why isn't there a universal response to it? Why isn't there a universal action that is just a high priority for all of us in all countries, in all places? And this is where this expression of delusion comes in. How delusion has this pervasive quality that can make us blind to what's present, what the reality of a situation like this is. It can also make us a sense of blindness of how our own actions have consequence. To help with an analogy of this, you know, many of us in the room have had different health conditions through the years. And sometimes those conditions that we, you know, they're more chronic and kind of slow growing, like, diabetes or high blood pressure and things like that, that we can make some concrete changes in our life. We can exercise and eat differently and meditate and things like that, right? But sometimes it's really hard to do that. There's this denial of that, I really should be doing that, but it'd be much easier to go back into my own habits. It's like there's this window that we have in our own bodies of making effectual change. And same too with the earth. The earth is starting to get sick, right? We can make a change in that trajectory. But it does require some significant changes of lifestyle, changes of how we act in the world, the choices we make, and how we influence others. So it's so easy to take our body for granted in this analogy, just, okay, it's always been there for me, I can continue to ignore it. We take the earth for granted, that it seems to take whatever we dish out, whatever we handle to it. Now I think related to both climate change and also our personal health, is that we have to weigh these factors of denial, of avoidance, and fear, and paralysis. We have to have the right ratio of fear and urgency that we can actually come into action. If we have too much of it, though, then we become paralyzed, and we don't do anything, or we give up, or fall back into unconsciousness. So finding that right ratio is really an individual place. You know, what's going to be too much for you that you become overwhelmed? What's enough input to bring a sense of urgency to kind of get through our inertia, these powers of delusion? Sometimes we get caught in the other cycle of being too obsessed, too worried about it. There's a sense of anxiety and fear that just pervades us, which also isn't so helpful for our actions. So you can see how this ties into to wise action, wise effort. You know, what's the right amount that gives that sense of energy, that urgency to act in a skillful way? How too much of that motivation can make us frenetic and ineffectual? Sometimes we need a little bit of fear to kind of break through our denial, to break through our complacency. So it's often helpful just to reflect, where am I on the spectrum of denial and panic? And where am I on that spectrum? Am I kind of like, oh, I'll take care of it next year? Or is there a sense of it being so in your face that you just can't help but read all the dire consequences, the predictions that are going on? So the key thing is, what allows you to actually take that information and act from it? To act from it. I mean, assuming most people, you know, listening, you know, in the room and on the internet have a basic agreement that climate change is an issue. But I would also wager that many of us could do much more in our own lives and much more in how we interface with politicians, with businesses to affect change, to apply our pressure in those ways. So we begin by looking at what the facts are. You know, what are the actual reality, the facts? One of the, in the homework sheet, I put down a website I found from NASA that has a nice overview of graphs and charts that can be very helpful to ground us in that. There's a sense of what is the facts. Rodney always used to say, you know, the facts are friendly. You know, that sense of meeting this moment's experience as clearly and directly as we can, there's a certain way we can relax into that. So as meditators are learning how to connect with this moment's experience, how is actually this breath, how is this sensation, free of our distortions of thoughts, of concepts, of selfing, right? From that same bedrock, then we can use that to meeting some of these, you know, this information of climate change. What are the facts? What can I actually do? What can I actually bring forth with my efforts around it? And as we open to this subject, you may notice you get a little sleepy, a little distracted, a little spacey. That's the power of delusion starting to come in, and the power of the hindrance of sloth and torpor. Or maybe there's a sense of worry, a sense of anxiety building. So notice how that can be aversion, restlessness and worry as the hindrances coming forth. So now, just find that course. Where can I stay centered? Where can I still stay connected to this moment while still having this input of this, the right action, the right effort? Part of this terrain is this movement from the self-focus, the self-obsession that we usually go through life into caring for others. And the natural expression of that can be into caring for the larger environment. Usually we come to practice fairly focused in on what really our own needs are, our own anxiety, our own worry, this difficult experience I'm trying to find some way of grappling with. And often we feel it closely, we see those are driven by our wanting and our diswanting. Our want, our sense of craving and aversion have very strong roots in that sense of how we look at ourselves. Then we start to learn to meditate, and we ask you just simply to meet this moment's experience, very simply, without thoughts, without elaboration, trying to relax the sense of preference. And that is actually teaching you a very different way to relate to life, free of this wanting and not wanting, free of the delusions, free of the greed and the hatred. And that starts to teach us something in a very fundamental way. Often we don't realize we're being taught that lesson. So it starts to transform our lives. Remember Sharon Salzberg would often say that when people were trying to evaluate their meditative practices, they would look at how their actual experience felt. And we could become frustrated or discouraged because they still felt all of the busy mind, the monkey mind, the inner turmoil. But she suggested that they ask the people around them, ask their friends or loved ones, their acquaintances. And often they would reflect, yeah, you actually are changing. You listen a little bit more closely. You listen a little bit more deeply. And sometimes that can be really helpful to encourage that the practice actually is working. While subjectively, we may just feel like we're in the midst of our muck and our confusion and our discomfort. So this movement from just meeting this moment's experience, it starts to transform how we relate to other people. I remember when I first started to go on retreats, you know, that, again, coming into that really self-concerned, self-focused way. And at one point, going through a lunch line, I realized, okay, here's the food, but there's all these people behind me, so how can I take what is appropriate for me with still awareness of all the people behind me? There's this almost unconscious transformation of self-focused to being aware of the larger group. And if you've ever been on a residential retreat, there's a way the group starts to kind of breathe together and move together. And there's this harmony that we're in silence, but we're all kind of working around each other and supporting each other in a very kind and sweet way. And so the same process starts to naturally extend outward when we come home as the practice becomes more of a transformational effect. We start to care for our loved ones in a different way, give a little bit more time of listening. Meeting strangers, meeting people we work with, that starts to show up as a transformation. So what's happening is we're loosening this self-focus and we're naturally starting to relate to other people as human beings, Just as I wish to be happy, they too wish to be happy. There's this natural transformation that starts to occur. So working with an environment, there's this other step. We have to stretch a little bit further beyond the people that we actually see and meet in our lives to actually realize there's this whole planet, that our state, our city, our town is just one little segment of a much larger whole. And start to recognize how, just on the lunch line, as I took food more than my share, that affected other people behind me. If I take more than my share of resources, that affects everyone else on the planet. Right? And even a further stretch is to go beyond just this present moment into the future. How these actions today affect the future generations. So there's a way that the practice naturally starts to incline us toward this. And so sometimes highlighting and really noticing it and bringing a little more energy to it can be very helpful. To reflect, okay, this choice I'm making right now, this purchase, this decision, how does this affect not only my own well-being? How does it affect the well-being of everyone that I know? How does it affect the well-being of everyone that I don't know? How does it affect the well-being of everyone who's yet to be born for many generations hence? And just that simple reflection can connect this deep, heartfelt transformation that the meditation practice gives us. And so then the practice is like there's a joy that, oh, I'm really caring for these other people, even though they may never know what is present, whatever is here. In the Mahayana tradition, there's this bodhisattva vow that's often recited at the end of services. And one version is that the many beings are numberless, and I vow to save them. Greed, hatred, and ignorance arise endlessly. I vow to abandon them. Dharma gates are countless. I vow to wake to them. Buddha's way is unsurpassed. I vow to embody it fully. So this beautiful vow here takes us beyond the normal sense of limitation of what I can accomplish, what I can do, and this full-hearted willingness to meet something that it seems like it's endless. And this is so helpful with something like climate change. It can seem so big and so beyond what I can do anything about. It's like you still, even though it's endless, I still vow to end it. I still vow to meet that. And letting it come from this heart, this warmth of the heart, this deep integrity that this is the most important thing, is to lead life from the heart, then the Dharma comes right into that seamlessly. And in this way, really we're talking about ethical conduct. But not as something that you should do, not as something that's been imposed by a authority, from a religious authority or whatever authority you might take. It's coming from internally, from this internal transformation. You know, often you'll learn in meditation to start to become kinder to yourself, because you realize that judging yourself, judging the fact, you get lost in thought, that the mind strays, that there's thoughts of wanting and not wanting. You realize that that judgment is just another thought. And at some point you realize, this is all just thought, and I don't have to participate in that. I don't have to engage in that. And instead, compassion starts to come in a true form, not in an imposed form. So this way, ethical conduct, the precepts, the right action from the Eightfold Path is not something externally imposed, but it's coming from internally. So this is one of the powers of having a contemplative practice. It's not something intellectual. It's something that's coming from your inner knowing. It's like the transformation's internal, and it naturally comes outward. Sometimes with causes, people sometimes come into that with a lot of passion and a lot of energy, which, you know, of course, has its transformational effect. But sometimes that external outward thing, there's this deficit inside that they're coming from. There's a sense of lack, the sense of unresolvedness that causes a lot of tension in their actions. As meditators, we have this potential for coming from a very integrated place. And that transforms how we meet another person, especially someone we might want to change their actions. Instead of shooting and othering them, we actually connect with them, you know, through our own ability to connect with ourselves. We have to be able to connect fully with ourselves. Just as the meditation, it's like we often think of our bodies as somewhat separate from the land, from the earth, but really the same elements flow through us. So as we connect more and more deeply with that, we sense that resonance with the earth and with others. That sense of starting to go beyond our own immediacy, our own sense of what we need for our own families, our own lifestyle, and into all the future generations. I mean, for many of us, you know, some of us in the room have children or grandchildren. Some, you know, many of us have nephews, nieces. We have that sense of the next generation. So that can be a nice way to play with this, to kind of connect with how. Like I often reflect on my 15-year-old daughter's, how is her life going to be based on how the choices we're making right here and right now? And what about her children and her children's children and her children's children's children? And how, what kind of land, what kind of environment, what kind of world do I want to leave for them? And there's this almost very potent potentiality that right now I can make a choice that can really influence her well-being for her generations and her children's generations and on to the future. So sometimes that reflection, that making it more concrete, can be really helpful. And see, oh, how can I affect change? How can I have this? So coming down from this inner transformation, then we ask, the Eightfold Path asks us to step out and say, how do we interface with the world? How do we actually act in the world? Show up in the world? And what can I do personally with my life, with my choices? And what can I do? The climate action, is it the Climate Action Group task? Climate Change Action Group. So that's a group within SIMS that have kind of spearheaded a lot of this input and requested this talk. And they have this nice set of precepts that they developed. That's in part of the homework. There's also a link to a set of actions that you can use, and real things to kind of go through and say, well, which one of these can I change? Maybe take a few of those a week and see, can I just add one of those and then add another one? And little by little, we start to amplify our change. You know, the people in this room amplifies out. The people listening on the internet, it amplifies out. Reflecting on who can I influence in my life? You know, who are the politicians that want my vote? Who are the companies that want my money? You know, what's the government workers who have to listen to us? You know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. You know, it's a very good saying that the input, you know, letting people know, that's what, so often we're very much based, we act on what is pushing us. There's a stronger push from many people that will change the government, it will change the politicians, it will change businesses through your choices, through your actions. So taking time to, you know, reflect on what's really effectual, which are some of the biggest polluters, what are the biggest effects, and how can I actually have some input? It may feel like, you know, again, what can I do? What can my one person do? That bodhisattva vow, even though it seems impossible, I still will try. I still will put that in. And enough of us do, it just starts to move, it starts to shift. And it shifts enough, then we literally save the planet. Now this is, I do want to bring up another Dharma gate around this. And then we have to be careful of our tendency to polarize, to create the sense of other. There's a sense of, okay, here we're all in this one camp. And there's this other group who are not in that camp. And they are bad. They are wrong. We need to get rid of them. We need to change their minds. And we have to realize we're in this all together. This has to be a partnership. There has to be a way of connecting with another person, especially someone who may have a different view, a different understanding. If we connect based on respect and understanding, then that partnership can take root. I remember, again, back in forestry school, studying some sociology, and there was a time when there was the, as we call it in the business, the spotted owl crisis. And so there was this whole kind of battle of trying to save old growth and using the spotted owl as a gateway with the Endangered Species Act to have legislation, right? So there's all that. You know, that much of the environmentalists, most of my colleagues in the class were along that camp. But there's the other side of it, which is the loggers, the people who, you know, their fathers were loggers and their grandfathers were loggers, and that's how their whole livelihood was based. And that sociology course, we also learned that it's not only their livelihood, it's their very sense of identity. And the very sense of identity is tied with that. So sometimes we come from this kind of, you know, greater than thou, higher than thou, you know, superior place and say, well, why don't you just stop logging, for example, and not realizing we're asking someone to fundamentally change the very basis they base their identity on, their very life they base it on. There's a little bit of an arrogance that we carry into that. So now to this present time, we can look at different countries who might be polluting quite a bit. And we look at where they are in terms of the development of the country. We look at our own country and how much do we pollute in our early stages, you know, after we had taken the land over from the Native Americans and, you know, create this sense of industrialization, you know, polluting and all this stuff. And we become cleaner and cleaner as we went along. But we've built a lot of wealth through taking those resources, through pollution. So going to a third world country and saying, you shouldn't pollute, you know, essentially saying you should stay in poverty. So you have to be willing to step into this sense of helping everyone up, everyone have enough stability. As Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, if we don't have enough food, enough basis of survival, we're not going to think about the greater good. We have to be willing to help the whole world come up to a higher level. So it kind of threatens our sense of capitalism, of competition, of being getting more than. So how can we have that sense of connecting with what that person might need, what that country might need, and connecting to this much greater good of protecting the planet? And that coming from this assumption that just because we have wealth, we have affluence, that we have stability in our lives, that they have that. I know some of us in the room, you know, know that very intimately from, you know, maybe from the country that we were raised in, that we came from, or our near relatives are. We realize that, yeah, there's the truth to that, that we have to connect with. So the point is really to just own our place of privilege, that we have a sense of being comfortable enough that we can really be concerned with this much greater picture. So we have to connect with where people are who aren't so comfortable, who are maybe more trying to survive, and start to build relationships and understanding for this common plight. So in this talk, I was kind of going back and forth with how much urgency to put into it, how much, you know, how much fear do you guys need, and how much reassurance? And again, it's all kind of, it's based on each person. Some people are doing a lot. Some people are a little sleepy in that whole process. So I was doing some research online, and one article talked about this intergovernmental panel on climate change, a group of scientists convened by the United Nations to guide world leaders, describes a world of worsening food shortages and wildfires and a mass die-off of coral reefs as soon as 2040. So that's 20, 21 years from now. You know, the period that's much within much of our lifetimes, you know, many of us in the room, and certainly our children and our grandchildren. So reflecting on my daughter again as a gateway, as a sense of bringing that urgency. You know, she would be 45 at that point. Is that right, or 35? 35. That's not so bad. Because that means I'm not going to be that old either. But imagine speaking to my grandchildren and ask if they ask a question like, "So, Grandpa, what did you do to stop climate change? What did you do? You know, however it turns out, what did you actually do? Did you actually do something to change?" I was asking my daughter about this, and one question she posed was, "How did you care for the world that I need to now live in?" You know, these questions brings that enough urgency to start to make real changes in our lives, changes how we care for the planet. Another thing my daughter said was, she's 15, that the older generations have ruined the earth for us. We have to do something about it in the next 12 years. But a lot of us don't have power as teens. People say, just let the adults take care of it. But they don't. And the final thing she said is that this reflection was, you know, imagine asking your grandchild asking you, you know, something like, "What was snow like? What was it like when there wasn't always tornadoes?" All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. As we sit, you get a sense of the solemnness of this responsibility that we all hold. And notice where the mind and heart may lean into a sense of overwhelm, of helplessness, or perhaps in another direction and of denial, of checking out. Trying to find a place in between. We know, yes, this is our responsibility to meet this challenge. And finding the sense of really power that we can make a change. That we can answer this question, what did you do to care for the planet? With a sense of pride, with a sense of, I did all that I could. And realizing that caring for the planet is no different than caring for this body. The same elements course through us, brought together by conditions to this body, are the same elements that form the mountains and the trees, the oceans. And relaxing into that connection. That it was always there, just often forgotten, overlooked. All right, thank you for your kind attention. Just to say a few words about the practice and reflection sheet for this coming week. So we'll have a discussion on this next week. We'll see how that goes. So the kind of the biggest thing with this topic is to reflect on it, but also be willing to take some concrete steps toward this. And one of the really important step you can do is there's the climate change task force, no, action group, is having a meeting on Saturday the 4th from 9:30 to 12. And it's a discussion. It's a chance to kind of flesh out some of these conversations, to kind of have a sense of finding some concrete things to do. And Iris and Lauren and Ken, I know, are kind of the, anyone else I forgot? The three of them. So raise your hands so you can talk to them about that meeting. And that's listed on the homework. So this week, and also for that event, reflect on how your understanding of Dharma helps you engage with climate change. You know, how does your practice actually take this Eightfold Path, if you imagine that being one of the path factors of how do I engage with caring for the environment? And in particular, can you recognize when denial and avoidance is an expression of delusion, that sense of wanting to check out? It can feel like this overwhelming wave, like, okay, I just can't, it's like in Wizard of Oz when they're going through the poppy fields and they're just all falling asleep. You know, it can feel like that. But you have this willingness, okay, I'm going to keep my course, even though I'm staggering and I can't see anything straight. That's actually going through that wave of delusion that we've been speaking about this week or this month in relationship to sloth and torpor. And secondly, can your commitment to non-harm extend to all beings, present and future? And that sense of non-harm can be a really simple way to bring all the precepts into a very manageable way. How can my actions be based in true non-harm? There's a precept for a livable planet that this group has worked a lot on that reframed the precepts in terms of climate change. So I encourage you to follow that link. And we'll put this on the website. Rob? Yes? Yeah, so we'll put this on the website so you can do the link right there if that's easier. And if you're on the internet, you can get to it. And then finally, how does the reality of human-caused climate change inform the scope of non-harm? And that's a little typo there, but you kind of got the gist of it. You know, how does it change and inform the scope of non-harm? How non-harm can go from just this interpersonal thing to this much intergenerational context. All right, so we have some time for any comments or questions about this topic or about your practice. Yes. You're very welcome. So just words of appreciation for the talk and the being willing to tackle it. You're very welcome. Yes.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that. I've always seen fear as sort of counterproductive to wise action.
Yeah, so that's a nice question around. I talked about fear, a little bit of fear can be helpful around this, but you've always thought about fear as being really counterproductive to wise action. And how does that work out? Well, fear, you know, has its place when it brings a sense of urgency and it can be like the rays of sun dispersing a fog that's obscuring our direction. We don't know where to go. It's like when you start to, like that Dorothy and her gang going through the poppy fields, you're just like, oh, I just can't think about this. A little bit of fear kind of brings that energy up, right? So sometimes we need that, especially something like this that seems You know, it's hard enough when it's an interpersonal thing, like a conflict with, it actually is my responsibility to talk to this person about this issue. You know, it's like it's really much in my field of control. Take something like climate change, it seems like it's so massive and so beyond my capacity. It's so easy to fall into that wave of unconsciousness and of delusion. And, you know, just, you know, maybe say, well, maybe, you know, some of those politicians are right. Maybe it's not a big deal, you know, whatever it might be. You just kind of, I'm going to go get to that later. So reflecting on that, it brings that sense of urgency. It's very similar to working with the reflection on your own mortality. That is when you bring that into your practice, okay, that this life is finite. It does not go on forever. That I am subject to death, just as everyone I know is subject to death. It's meant to not throw us into despair and depression, not into paralyzing fear, but bring a little bit of fear can start to enliven us. So we actually live life in a much more full way, fully meeting this moment's experience. Not thinking, oh, I have many tomorrows to deal with this. Like, no, I don't know if I have that. I'm going to meet this. So same too with a little bit of reflecting on the consequences of climate change, you know, the reality of it, can bring that enough energy to say, okay, how am I going to actually act around this? Does that make sense? But we can go too far. We can become very obsessed. Just like I use the analogy of a health problem, because sometimes we get on the internet and we say, oh man, that achy shoulder is like, I didn't have no idea it could be all these things, and I probably have at least five of them. You know, and we don't have the perspective to realize, no, that's not fitting in. So you really have to know your own mind. It's like the Dharma is often spoken of as medicine, right? But one person's medicine may be another person's poison, right? So if we tend to be very anxious and worried and kind of everything is really kind of a big deal in terms of to worry about, we need to emphasize more calming, you know, and say, okay, what's right in front of me that I can do? I'm gonna get a LED light bulb instead of a, you know, whatever it might be, something really clear and simple. So it's kind of that, you have to really find that balance. So it's hard doing a talk in front of 60 people and how many people online that you know, you can't quite tailor make it. But so hopefully we have that discernment, like, okay, that's a little too much gas in the fear engine and I need to back off on that. Or, yeah, my car is stalled. I need to put some more octane in that. You're welcome. Yes.
I recently attended a workshop on bottom-line grief. And I found it very helpful to acknowledge grief over what is already I want the people around me to be happy. And so I go along with our you know? And yet, underneath, all of us are aware and we're sort of grieving and we're not sharing because we don't want to disturb the group. And I just offer that as something that was very powerful for me about acknowledging grief.
Yes, nice. So to reflect that for the recording, that attending a workshop or a class, a retreat on environmental grieving, and how that was really a helpful way to acknowledge what has already been lost, and what has already gone too far to reverse some changes, and acknowledging that grief, and how so often we, as a culture, we walk through with this level of denial of the grief, denial of the losses that have already happened through our actions, through the environmental change. And yet we often tend to want to, you know, put on the happy face. You know, kind of keep, yeah, everyone seems to be happy. I don't want to be the downer in the room that says, well, yeah, you know, we've, because you want people to be happy and joyful. And but yet there's this important part of is really this interesting relationship between you know, grief and joy, right? We tend to think of them as mutually exclusive. You know, just same thing with really death and life, reflecting on death and life, and they seem like they're mutually exclusive. But reflecting on grief, really grieving well, allows us to have much more access to joy, to actually appreciate, you know, what is beautiful in nature, to realize there is a fleeting quality to it. I think so many of our ailments, you know, psychologically is around grief, whether it's interpersonal, and this is a whole nother level of grief that we're having. And, you know, it's interesting just reflecting on my, you know, being a father, there's all this teaching that comes from that. It's hard to avoid that. And just reflecting on, here's another generation that there's things that I've experienced that she'll never experience. You know, there's glaciers I've climbed that are no longer there. You know, there's these things that just change, and it's that there's that grief of that. There's a species that we'll never know. You know, and it brings, if you again, you have to look at, how am I working with it? The right way to work with it is to open into the sadness of it, but not in a way that becomes contracted. You know, and so that's one of the tricks with grief, is that there's a tendency, because it hurts, to kind of get tight around it, to get around it, you know, literally in this kind of a position. We can allow the grief to flow through us, so it's like this elemental thing that moves through our hearts and our bodies, then it can cleanse. And the cleansing then sets us up to live more fully. And around environmental grief, it brings us that great basis for action. Because there's this urgency. This is an important topic. Yeah, so thank you for bringing that up. Yes?
I don't think I can speak clearly about the idea that I have in my head.
Well, do your best you can. We'll muddle through it together.
Yeah.
Yes.
But we project into the future to give us direction and guidance and understanding of our present.
Yes.
But climate change, the terror, the fear, the grief, the uncertainty of the future causes a very different way of looking at our present experience.
Hmm.
I can't help wondering, and I know I'm not saying this.
No, you're fine, yeah.
Yeah, that it's a little different than a lot of the other kinds of things that we think about and talk about in our normal projection of life, in our normal understanding in history. I mean, I understand you have when I was young, we were terrified that there would be nuclear. Different.
Hmm.
I don't know. So what happens is, with the annihilation or the obscuration or the threat of any future, it has an enormous impact on our ability to be present.
Hmm. Yeah, especially that last piece there. So just to paraphrase that. So typically we tend to reflect on the past to inform the present, and also the future to inform, you know, how do we act in the present. And that's part of our, it's really one of our big advantages of humans. We can do that. Meditation, we of course look at the limitations of that, you know, not living in the present moment. But we don't want to avoid, you know, planning for the future. Now, there's a normal mechanism, but you're reflecting on how the kind of the terror of the climate change and the projections and all that, worst case scenarios, tends to have a paralysis effect in this present moment. Our actions aren't like, we can't be so clear-headed, oh, I have to do X, Y, and Z. It's more like, kind of, is that sort of what you're talking about? Yeah.
I think that's relatively normal.
Yeah. The choices we make now are always based on some projection in the future. Yeah. And it's important to realize that those are projections. you know, there's always ideas. I was teaching on Inauguration Day, you know, Election Day, and there's, you know, there's a lot of projection of how the future will be. So be curious to see, you know, how does that match up? Is it better or worse? The fact is we don't know. That's where the really, you have to ground in the present moment. We don't know how the future will be. You know, we just don't know. And yet there's also data that's showing that this trajectory of actions is going to cause trouble. Like anything, it's cause and effect. If I was spending $10 more than I make a month, you know, eventually I will go bankrupt. You know, that's a clear trajectory. So it's kind of, it's the willingness to be able to hold the capacity of the fear and realize, okay, that's the future, that's my fear of the future. So you have to kind of clear the fear of the future to say, well, what's the course that's the most helpful? So, you know, again, the part of this is the carburetor setting of how much fear and how much, you know, action. You know, so there might be a little too much fear in the system that's making the present not so clear to navigate. Yeah, so don't think about it maybe so much and just say, well, what can I do? Again, it goes back to that medicine. You know, sometimes we need to back off our fearful response so we can act. And so I kind of erred a little bit on waking people up, but hopefully you're not going to, hopefully everyone can sleep well tonight. And all right, any other, yes, Daniel.
Generations can be a joyful project.
Yes.
And I think that those of us that we spend a lot of time looking at the nature of suffering in this practice, and I think that sometimes we approach everything as a damage control project, but to approach this with love and with a sense of joy actually pulls you into it rather than being pushed forward by fear. And I think that if we could try to bring some of that into just looking at the decisions we make, that could be a different type of motivator where you're pulled forward because of these qualities of caring.
Yes. Yeah, that's...
Thank you for mentioning that. When you said that in your talk, I just really woke up a little bit. I just wanted to emphasize that and say that I really appreciate it.
Good, yeah, thank you for that. I forgot I said that. But that's the comment was that during the talk I expressed that inner joy that we can have for caring for another person, and same thing, caring for the next generations, and bringing that forth can be a really helpful, different motivation than fear and panic, is a nice answer to what Sarah Lee was talking about, is that the connecting with how my actions are actually helping someone else. And then it's a different motivation. And then we do tend to, you know, our bias in practice tends to be, as you said, damage control, and we tend to focus on what's wrong. This unfortunately ties in nicely with or resonates strongly with our evolutionary advantage of focusing on what's dangerous in the environment. You know, forget about what's good. Focus on what's going to kill you or eat you or poison you. That's what you got to pay attention to. And so then we plug that in. And we, like our whole neurology, our autonomic nervous system is really tied to pay attention. Our adrenal system, everything is really mobilized for that. So we often have to, okay, really reflect on what is the positive aspect? What's the act of generosity, of kindness, of care, of love? I mean, there's this sutta where this prince is commenting on the Buddha's followers and said, you know, I can always tell who your followers are because they're always walking around with big smiles on their face. They seem really happy. While, you know, the other people are like torturing themselves, standing on one leg and, you know, in a very different experience. And sometimes I think we've kind of lost something in our translation because we get a little dour, you know, we get a little bit heavy, you know. And so to remember that lightness, there's a nice series of reflections with Donna, with the act of giving. And that sense of reflecting on the intention to give really brightens the heart. The actual act of giving brightens the heart. And reflecting on it afterwards brightens the heart. So we could use that sense of dana, sense of generosity toward the next generations. And that's a nice note to bring that up. So thank you, Daniel, that, you know, reflect on, maybe we'll talk about that next week. That'd be a more uplifting way to work with it. That sense of reflecting on how we can really care. You know, is that the question, you know, with my projected grandchildren asking me, you know, what did you do? It's like, well, this is what I did. You know, my daughter was really worried about climate change a few years ago when she was, I don't know, fifth grade, sixth grade. I said, well, you know, look, we've planted all these trees. We've done all these things in our environment that have, you know, changed our carbon footprint. She's like, oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that back in. All right, any other comments or questions out there? Yes, Valerie.
With the current administration thinking that climate change is a hoax, and a lot of the data is been taken away from the EPA website. So I guess the question is, what can we do to continue spreading the news to make it clear that this really is happening and it's not just a hoax?
Mm.
And that's my concern right now, is we can do as much as we can on our side, but the larger picture is that someone else is in control, spreading fracking and coal.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's disheartening at the same time to see that we're going backwards from today.
Yeah.
I'm at a loss.
Yeah, so the comment was around the sense of feeling like as a country we've taken a backward step. There's a lot of denial of climate change and outright acting in opposition to, you know, to that reality in a really destructive way. And the, there's, you know, the grief around that. There's a sense of, you know, what can I do about this? Because there's all this, the powers that be are kind of in a different mode. So, I mean, there's many different ways. You know, one is to, and one of your questions is, how do we influence? So you can step back. If you can kind of, again, balance your fear and your urgency to be more clear-headed, it's like, well, how can I be strategic about this? Who can I actually influence? Who cares about what I think? Well, you know, the people who I vote for do. You know, so that's one avenue that you can, we certainly all should vote. We should all contact our representatives, our senators. We can contact people who aren't our senators and see, can we start to influence them? How can I reach that person's perspective in a way that starts to change their mind? You know, those kind of, those things. Looking at companies that maybe are using too much of their resources or creating too much greenhouse, saying, you know, I'm not going to use your company, and this is why. You know, that kind of communication. Those little steps may not seem like very much, but it can actually add up. You know, so, you know, finding a way to try, you know, to find what's the biggest problem and how can I have some entry into that. But we have to be clear-headed, and the best way to be clear-headed is to come into our bodies. This is where the science of mindfulness comes in. With when we get stressed out, we lose our ability to be in our prefrontal cortex. We become not as smart. We're not able to access the information that we do have. Mindfulness has been shown to actually allow us to shift back into that, to actually be able to have much more of our ability to reason, to think things through. Yeah, and it's discouraging. You know, it takes a lot of willingness to say, okay, even though the suffering is immeasurable, I'm going to still do my best. I'm still going to vow to overcome it. All right, so I'm going to end for this part tonight. Thank you for your engagement. And again, next week we'll have a discussion on this. And then May 4th, put on your calendars, there'll be a facilitated discussion around this. So some of those questions, that would be a great question to bring there and say, what do we do? That's a great question to bring up, as is Daniel's, is all these questions. Okay, so announcements. So I want to announce where we're moving for those who